Welcome to BurningTruck.com. This is show BT-118, Today's Dragons. Robert Moore opens up with a warning about what happens when we ignore the collective unconscious. This collective unconscious shows up as dragon imagery across cultures throughout human history. He also points out that this collective unconscious is a treasure source for our creativity. You'll hear about the hope of creative order and what we can do about it. If you listen carefully, you'll hear some very wise advice. Thanks for listening.
Let's welcome Robert Moore.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here tonight, and I want to thank so many of you for coming out on a Friday night to be with us to talk about Jungian psychology and some of Jung's key concepts. Tonight, I said that I was going to be speaking a lot about the archetypal image of the dragon in myth and psyche. And the context for that is in Jungian studies of the archetypal self. We're going to be focusing a lot on the archetypal self and its importance for the human personality. I'm going to focus a lot on the imagery. Now, we are in the aftermath as a country of seeing the archetypal energies run amok and result in mass killing. This kind of compulsive behavior is growing in the world. It's impossible to understand the epidemic of compulsive behaviors on this planet without understanding the reality behind Jung's concept of the archetypal self. The idea of the collective unconscious and the idea that in that collective unconscious is a psychological reality, a psychological entity that is not the I of the person, it's not the ego, it's not the personal self of the individual, but it is always present in the human psyche. It is the source of these huge creative energies that exist in the human psyche. But that's the good news. It's also the source of all of those energies which human beings struggle to regulate and to keep from becoming dysfunctional or destructive. Jung believed that the almost universal tendency of human beings to seek a center out there was an expression of this deep reality in the psyche. But Jung came along and he said this tendency for human beings in history to seek for the center out there, he said that was a projection of an image of the archetypal self. But what I want to emphasize to you tonight is that there's another aspect that was very important in Jung's work that gets neglected today by a lot of contemporary Jungians. And that is his fascination with and the sense of the importance of psychic energy, what we can call archetypal energy. Well, what I want you to realize is that the more you study the archetypal self, the more you will realize that it's hot in there. And it's no accident that in religious traditions around the world, the sacred has been associated a great deal with fire. So I want you to take a moment and think about the images from different traditions that you know about which consider fire sacred. I think that the archetype of the dragon, the image of the dragon, is extremely important for getting a realistic feel for the nature and dynamics of the archetypal self. Because it is an image which not only speaks of the energies that come into the world, it not only speaks about the need for orientation, but it gives you a sense of the magnitude of the energy which is in the deep psyche. There are many psychological theories today that don't have any concept which can address what is known in psychoanalysis today as, forgive me for this, but this is the fancy phrase, grandiose exhibitionistic libido. Grandiose exhibitionistic libido. If you've ever seen anyone in a manic state, then you've been in the presence of a manifestation of grandiose exhibitionistic libido. It's really simply a very raw form of archetypal energy. So you can think about what you think of when you hear the word dragon, but you know, probably what you're going to think of is heavily influenced by the fact that you live in Western culture. Because there's different images of the dragon in Western culture and in Eastern culture. In Western culture, the dragon is seen to be very, very much a dangerous figure, and it's something that our spiritual teachers in the past have wanted us to kill. Saint George and the dragon. In Eastern culture, however, the dragon is seen as a beneficent force, still hugely powerful, still trafficking in fire and great energies, but also a source of blessing and prosperity. So you need to keep those images in mind. What we're going to see is a range of potential relationships between it. I'm going to call it it. Freud called the big thing in the psyche the id, translating that it. It's the big it. The warrior, you know, the warrior archetype is an archetype, if it moves, the warrior's going to fight it. The warrior, you know, it's always us and them. And as we know from certain political figures, the warrior's not the smartest figure in the pantheon of archetypes. Now, if you're in great danger, sometimes you need to have a functional warrior. Like when this thing gets loose on campus and it has taken over a human being, then you need police sooner rather than later. Let's see the next slide. Here is a kind of a Gandalf figure. Something different has broken in here now, another archetype of potential. It is someone who has the capacity through the left hand, which is an image of magic, to make a direct connection to the dragon's heart. There is intuition. This is a representation of that thing in you, which when confronted with these archetypal energies of the psyche, it doesn't have to just become paranoid about them and try to pretend they don't exist. There is something in you which can begin, while still being vigilant, to try to make some kind of connection with this thing. There are you and me when we're trying to figure out why our behavior is so self-destructive. In fact, there's a lot of traditions, you know, that tend to want to equate the dragon with the feminine, particularly men. Unfortunately, inflated dragon energy is an equal opportunity scourge. Affects both males and females. So I always point out to people there are four couples in the psyche, a warrior couple, magician couple, a lover couple, and a royal couple. Well, I love to say to people, well, you know, while, you know, rodeos where people want to ride the bull and the cowboy fantasy of breaking the horse, there's always that kind of fantasy about domesticating these archetypal energies. You know, like you're either going to kill it or you're going to break it. But unfortunately, that's not going to work. You cannot domesticate. This thing here is not attacking, but it is not domesticated. And the important thing that Jungian psychology has added that no other psychology deals with, even the best of recent derivatives of Freud's work, this thing cannot be analyzed out of existence. You can't, you can have lots of therapy. You can have all kinds of therapy with the best Jungian analyst here in town. And this thing is not going to lose one bit of its archetypal energy. And that's something we got to think about. You know, a lot of people talk as if their archetypal self belongs to them. No. The ego, if anything, belongs to the archetypal self. And if you want a Jungian analyst that understands this better than anybody before or since, it was the great Edward Edinger. You never go wrong reading Edward Edinger's work. I try to stand in his tradition. One of the motifs that you see throughout folklore around the world is that there is a treasure that exists in proximity with it, with it. You can be thinking about, well, now what is that? What's that about? Well, it's about a lot of things, and we can talk about it. But to the extent that you have any creativity at all, it's not coming out of your ego. This is the energy source of your creativity. And so if you're bringing forth treasure in poetry, or you're bringing forth treasure in writing songs, or you're bringing forth treasure in fresh new ideas, if you're bringing forth treasure as a painter or an artist, the source with a capital S, speaking psychologically, you can use spiritual language if you wish, but this is the psychology of the phenomenon that spiritual language describes. So there's always a treasure, and there's a great deal of lore I've been looking at about what determines who gets any of that and who doesn't, who gets eaten on the way. There's a lot of lore in human history about making offerings, sacrificing virgins to it. See, there's Shane here. She's not there by her personal desire. It's another kind of ugly habit of our species. You know, we'll be talking about this weekend, about the importance of sacrifice, of making offerings to the great reality, to the great being. But human beings developed a nasty habit a long time ago of not wanting to offer themselves. They want to offer somebody else. We're talking about different ways human beings seek to relate to the big reality in the psyche. Antagonism can try to be ignorant of it, but it doesn't much appreciate being ignored. You can fight with it, or you can start trying to form a relationship with it, a conscious relationship with it, so that you're actually working at common purposes. Let's go to the next one. One of the things I want you to think about this now, you've heard people talk about wanting to make offerings to the dragons or to the divine, try to keep it placated. And I like to say to people, it's very important to respect it, because if you don't respect it, it tends to resent it. It's very interesting here. This relationship is not one of fear, and it's not just a power relationship. There are ways in which the relationship between the human ego and it can never be equal, because the power differential is enormously different. It does not have to be a relationship of fear. And at the further reaches of what Jung called individuation, the relationship between the ego personality and the unconscious, the archetypal self as it manifests through dreams and through other manifestations, becomes quite intimate. When I work with someone over a long period of time and I get to witness their increasing relationship with the big reality in their unconscious, I'll often see a deepening kind of empathy and relatedness. So I think you ought to pay attention and think about that image. If you think about the way the unconscious deals with you and your creativity, you can say that that it will trust you with the products of its creativity, provided you don't get too arrogant about it, in which case you'll have a hard time with that second novel. I said that there's an increasing epidemic of compulsive behaviors in the world now. We're seeing all kinds of phenomena related, a lot of different manifestations. But what I want you to think about is that from a Jungian point of view, that increasing compulsivity we're seeing, whether it's manifesting in addiction or whether it's manifesting in consumerism or the eating of the planet, whatever form it takes, from a Jungian point of view, that's a phenomenon of unregulated archetypal energies, dragon energies. We have to think, well, what's going on that things are getting worse? Well, one of the things that I like to tell people is that if you study human history and you study the way in which most of the peoples of the earth throughout history have invested their gross national product, human beings strove mightily to develop what we could call technologies of the sacred, which were attempting to be respectful of great energies that they knew surrounded them. And they came up with all sorts of ritual processes, and every group came up with some iteration of sacrificial offerings of some kind. It was something like this. Human beings had this sense, there's something big, it wants something. If I don't give it something, bad things are going to happen. And if that, this is pretty much worldwide. Well, you know, the technologies of the sacred have been in decline, radical decline all over the world. There's been far less resources going into anything spiritual having to do with relating to sacred energies or these large, scary energies. And guess what? Human beings are getting worse at relating to big energies. So this is not merely an academic thing here. And so one of our problems that we've got to face as a culture, and not only as our culture, but around the world, is what has to be done to help human beings again, help them be able to be aware of the big things and be able to relate to them more consciously and without as much destructive acting out. So that's a larger context. Jung's concept of the archetypal self really matters. It's not just another little concept. It's about a reality he believed was in the psyche of every person. It is a reality that seeks relationship with the conscious mind. When it does not get it, bad things can happen. So at the core, I think, of Jungian psychology is the importance of trying to understand archetypes, not because you just are quaintly interested in archetypes, but because you understand that they carry energy that you actually need, and that if you want to relate to them constructively, it takes some effort. You got to try to learn about them, and then you make the effort to have a relationship. When these energies are related to disrespectfully, they tend to create various kinds of conflagrations, and they're very contagious. So in other words, when there's an outbreak, we're seeing this around the country now. You know, we have this event in Virginia, then we have a bomb scare in Minneapolis. Then we have bomb scares at a bunch of other places around the country. The so-called copycat phenomenon. There are lots of different kinds of behaviors. Not all of them are archetypally fueled in the same way. And when a form of behavior manifests in human society that is clearly kind of archetypally generated, it creates a kind of a hysterical reaction. Out of control human energies create more. They invoke more out of controlness. The ancient peoples of the world used to know chaos breeds chaos. Chaos is contagious. And that's why they were so preoccupied with taboos and things like that, because they thought you needed insulation against that. And so the good news, though, is that creative order is contagious, too. So that's where some of the hope is, you know. So Jung and Edinger and a lot of people believe that to the extent that you can develop an inner respectful relationship with the great energies in you and become a really creatively ordered personality, that instead of spreading chaos in your environment, in your community, you actually spread creative order. There's a lot more connection between people than we realize. A bad relationship to these energies is contagious. A good relationship to them is contagious. Humans have always been fascinated and horrified by grandiosity. That's what they have feared the most. And all the spiritual traditions have a language for it. And what you're pointing at is that when somebody is really in their grandiosity, they really are vulnerable. And they do have an Achilles heel that will quickly puncture it and it will crash. Human beings have known that connection with these energies is dangerous. It's always dangerous. It's never just ordinary. It's always extraordinary. But with respect, the first thing that comes, you got to be able to know it exists first. Then respect it. And then begin trying to create a higher level of relationship to it. When we see these images of needing to kill the dragon, a lot of the time human beings have seen what happens when that spirit thing runs amok. And they know, that's where we get all the lore of demon possession. I don't know whether you've ever studied any of that stuff, but I've studied it a lot. And human beings always have known when something not human comes in. And it comes in and all hell breaks loose. If it comes in uninvited, even if it is not really necessarily an evil energy, if it comes in uninvited, it usually creates havoc. So the sense of being fearful, that's better than being disrespectful. If you're fearful, you're less likely to get destroyed by it. Once it has possessed someone, then you have to find the chink. In my Facing the Dragon book, I talk about, you know, the difficulty of people coming to an awareness of this reality of the archetypal self. And in the follow-up volumes I'm working on, I'm going to be talking more about developing a relationship and then the farther reaches of the possibility of a friendship or an intimate relationship with these energies. I think it's very important today in our world to remember that human beings are capable of fabulous, great things, because we see so much ugliness, we see so much tragedy, that a lot of people, nihilism is probably the most dangerous temptation, the attractiveness of nihilism and cynicism. I think it's important to realize that these great energies do exist. They're meant for creativity, not destruction. And we got to hold on to that in these next 20 years. We're going to need to hold on to that. Yes, back here.
Is it possible to avoid these energies and still have some kind of a life?
Well, if you like depression, if you like depression, you can try to banish these great energies from your conscious mind. Depending on how well your defenses are put together, you might be able to maintain a pretty constant depression, which a lot of people call sort of ordinary life. And you know, the truth is, a lot of people, they kind of think that's the peace they ought to make with things, you know. And we have this concept in Jungian psychology, which we call defense against the numinous, which means defense against that radiant thing in you. Why defend against it? I mean, say, why would you want to defend against the God energy? Well, our forebears got it. They knew why. Because it's dangerous. And it's better to be just chronically depressed than to be completely blasted to bits by merger with it. Because if you get too close to this thing in a disrespectful way, you'll be psychotic, flagrantly psychotic.
But there are other options.
Thank goodness. There are other options. And as I say, our forebears, our human forebears, put a lot of energy in studying the options of how to relate to these energies in ways that facilitated a habitat for the human and sought to make for meaningful living, respectful living. So it's not necessary to have it manifest destructively. But I think a lot of people, to honor your question, I think a lot of people do take refuge in a low-grade depression because they have a sense that there's something in there and they just want to stay away from it because they think it's crazy. And of course, it's connected to, it has a lot of crazy expressions, yes.
Just as childhood is the search for purpose for my existence. So now I think I can reframe that as trying to get connected to this, because a purposeless life is draining, depressing. And I see that being called depression, clinical depression, as opposed to, is this all there is? There is more than this, and I've been told to discount that. That's just depression.
It's like, you hear what she's saying, and she knows what she's talking about. She's a psychiatrist. The thing is, this psychological reality is the engine of a sense of meaning in your life. If you're not connected to it, you don't feel a sense of much meaning. If you lose your boundary with it, you will be consumed with meaning. You will have an excess of meaning, and every little wrinkle in this floor is a revelation. The thing is, our forebears never experienced meaninglessness like moderns do, because they had a sense of connection to this thing. They had a surplus of meaning. It's hard for moderns to imagine being hooked up to a fountain of meaning. The truth is, you have a fountain of meaning in you. And if you're feeling that your life is aimless and meaninglessness, it means you're cut off from it. But you're only cut off of it in your ego. Because it's impossible for you to be, in principle, internally cut off from it. So you may be suppressing your sense of meaning in order to... I get a kick out of human beings. They all want to feel alone all the time in the psyche. Well, I've come to believe that if you feel alone in your psyche, you are doing everything you can to keep the awareness of this big entity in there with you. Because I've come to believe that the proper attitude of you in your psyche is we, the ego and the larger psyche. So I often say to people, and I'm not kidding, when you wake up in the morning, it's a good thing to greet the larger psyche. Because if you greet it, what? You're not having a fantasy, you're alone in your psyche. I suggest that you try that. First thing in the morning, you greet your larger psyche, say, what are we going to do today? What are we going to do today? This is all just about what Jungians talk about, is developing ego-self relationship through active imagination, through working with your dreams. I call it practicing the presence. Because it's always present. And if I am not aware that it's present, it hasn't gone away. I've just sort of dumbed down my awareness.
You mentioned the different tradition in the collective Eastern or Chinese.
Yes, Eastern philosophies with regard to the what the dragon is. Well, I think it's fierce, but there's just a very different attitude, well, in the Asian tradition, to the Tao, to heaven. The heaven is always present. Heaven is present. It's not starting out with the idea it is antagonistic. See, I mean, that warrior thing in the Western psyche is very interesting. You know, it's if I experience a presence, it may be hostile. But in the Asian psyche, there's not as much of that I and you stuff, usually. So I just think one way to think about that is that there are a lot of different ways to image your relationship to the great forces. In the mythology of China and Taoism, you get a healthier attitude. If you study the Tao Te Ching, you get that sense of whether or not I'm relating to heaven right today. Am I in the flow today, or am I kind of out of the flow today?
I'm just dying to know how you became engaged with this whole set of concepts. What happened to you, or
Well, I grew up in a family that was so complicated that I think I probably decided when I was about eight I needed to become a shrink to figure it out. But actually, I've always been interested in the relationship between spirituality and psychology, because I intuited very early on that there was a lot of wisdom about the human, long before there was such a thing as the discipline of psychology. I've never changed my mind about that. I was about 23 years old, and I ran into this young professor who had studied Jung, among other things, and I went to his class one day. He was talking about Jung and process philosophy and general systems theory and all those things, and it was just like you gave me a LSD pill, you know. Blew my mind. And then, so from age 23 on, 40 years, I've been pursuing that same thing that he showed me. Never regretted it. So it's been a long haul.
Yeah, how do you know if you're greeting this self too much?
Well, if you're not greeting it, you're much more likely to be possessed by it. So being alone in your psyche, that's like being king of the mountain. I'm not saying that you can't be really grandiose and practice a spirituality, because that's obviously not true. The use that human beings have made of mythic images and mythic spiritual traditions, they have had a sense that they had to have a vessel to carry a lot of that God energy. That if they did not have a vessel to carry it, so that they could relate to it consciously and intentionally. I think intention is so important. You know, a lot of people talk about conscious intention today. The intention you bring to the relationship with your psyche is extremely important. And there are people who are sort of what I call sorcerers. They are people who want a relationship with the unconscious so they have more power and so they can be more manipulative. So there is a lot of that, and that's all the spiritual traditions have recognized that. So if you saw Lord of the Rings, you saw that there are some magicians that are very skilled, but they want to use it for power and manipulation. So that is a problem. The Buddhists talk about right intention, the importance of right intention. And when it comes to relationship with your psyche, right intention. You want a partnership. You want a creative partnership with your psyche. And if that is your intention, my experience is you'll have a real good shot at getting it.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. Please visit Moore's website, www.robertmoorephd.com. That's spelled R-O-B-E-R-T. MOOREPHD.com. This talk was presented in April 2007 in St. Paul, Minnesota. This is John Tisberg from BurningTruck.com. Thanks for listening.